Thanks for joining us today. Go around and say hello to everyone. So starting with Mark W, just in case the other Mark is here. Jinryu, Jeannie, David O, Bob K, Mary, Richard, Dave, So-on, Paulette, Shoketsu, Sam, Jim, Joe, and Lori, Ruth Ann, Joan, Bob O, Marv, Pat, Dawn, Sydney, Zach, Amanda, Jessica, and on to the next page, let's see, Yeshe Soki, Tyler, Diane, Linda, Bruce, and Hannah. All right, good turnout today for a special talk. yes, in terms of announcements, we have a person who assists us with office admin stuff, and she's the one that usually reminds me that stuff is coming up. She says, wonder, should we be announcing this thing that's coming up next month? So she reminded me of our fall term student program. And we are going to have that. It will be adapted for being online via Zoom. So I encourage you to, we'll be sending out a special message about it this week, and it'll also be in the new regular newsletter. It is on the website as well under term student, and basically it is a 3 or so month program where people form a cohort, signing up for the program, and there's a beginning retreat and an ending retreat, and you're encouraged to go to the kind of open retreats that happen in between. And over the course of that time, you come up with a set of personal vows. They can be anything you like. They can be elaborate. They can be simple. There's some guidance on the website about making vows, of, you know, deciding what your vows should be. And basically, over the course of that 3 months, people get to know each other better who are in the program, and support one another and feel supported in staying true to their intentions. So the first, the opening retreat, it'll be on our calendar. I think it is coming up quite soon, September 12th, but it will be shorter than the usual term student opening retreat is usually most of a day. It'll just be from about 8:30. We'll start on a Saturday with sitting as usual, and then it'll only go till about noon. What we'll do is break into smaller groups of about 4 to share our life stories, as is the first part, the part of the first retreat. Ordinarily, we stay in a group of 8 to 10, sometimes even more, because we really want to hear each other's stories, but that just seemed just way too much to do on Zoom. So we'll have to kind of just limit it. You'll be able to, you know, stay in a cohort of folks like that. Any questions about that or anything else? All right. I guess at this point then I will turn it over to Mark. And you may have something you're going to say about this as well, Mark, but essentially what I've asked senior students to do, and when a Sangha as young as ours, you don't have to have been around all that long to be a senior student. You have to, like, taken Jukai, been around for, you know, maybe 5 years, something like that. And So, it's not like you have to be an expert on things in order to be a senior student, but you're grounded in your practice. And what I've asked the senior students to do is to consider giving a way-seeking mind talk, which is essentially the idea is that all of us are on a spiritual journey. We've all had experiences, we've all learned stuff, and therefore we have things to, I mean, I don't know if it teach, I guess it would be teach, right? I mean, if somebody is open, we have things that we have learned that are interesting and valuable. So the way seeking mind talk is giving folks and the speaking seat to share that. So with no further ado then. Oh, and just one more thing on in terms of Zoom, I don't know if you guys are aware, but you depending on what you're viewing the Zoom on, you can have a gallery view where you see everybody, or a speaker view where the speaker's picture gets larger. And it's totally up to you, but sometimes putting the speaker view on helps you feel a little less distracted by all the stuff that's going on in the gallery view and a little more focused on the speaker, as if you were in person. So, yeah, go ahead, Mark.
All right. Tomio did a good job of introducing what these talks are about, since it's been a couple of years since we had one. But before I dig too far into it, I'd also like to sort of plug the process. This has been a wonderful and fascinating exercise just to figure out what I would say. So anybody who got that call to do one of these, who's sort of hesitant, taking on the process of figuring out what you can say and deciding to actually do the talk are two different things if you want them to be. So now I'll talk into it. I'm going to tend to want to begin at the beginning. So my spiritual background is I was raised Catholic, not Christmas and Easter Catholic, every Sunday Catholic, and at times every single day Catholic. And I spent summers with my grandparents, and my grandmother had been a Sunday school teacher, and she would pray for hours every day, the rosary or the novena of the rosary, for peace or the poor or for the sick or the dead. And I often prayed it with her those summers. We get really frustrated these days, I think, with that phrase, thoughts and prayers, but to be in the prayers of someone who truly prays is to be all the way inside their heart. So part of my early spiritual journey was just that sweetness of deep devotion. And when I was older and I was old enough to study the catechism, one of the nuns in our parish told me that Jesus had given us two commandments to replace the ten, and that everything he taught was encapsulated in them. One was love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second was love your neighbor as yourself. And I like those. They're sensible, they're straightforward, and I felt that you could give your life to living up to them or trying to live up to them and live beautifully for having done so. And because of that, I identified as a Christian long after I stopped practicing as one. Of course, it wasn't all wine and roses with Catholicism. My buddy Marshall likes to say, there's no such thing as a good Catholic, only Catholics who aren't good enough. And there's some truth in that, because shame is a central aspect of that religion. In Catholicism, if you don't do the right things, even God will reject you. So when I say shame, I'm borrowing Brené Brown's definition, which is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing we are flawed and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. For what it's worth, Buddhist teacher Thera Brach calls this same experience the trance of unworthiness. So I learned shame, but it wasn't just my indoctrination or my upbringing that taught it to me. To some degree, I think I'm also just inclined that way to feeling like I don't belong or can't belong. And once that pattern of thought that says I'm unworthy or there's something wrong with me is established, every difficulty strengthens it and solidifies it in your mind. Of course, this isn't supposed to be a talk about karmic conditioning, but the things we struggle with are weirdly helpful in the sense that affliction demands treatment. Some part of my mind seeking the way comes from suffering itself. So what was my early treatment strategy? It was hold it together through sheer force of will, if you have to, earn it. Be careful, thorough, methodical. Work smarter when you can and harder when you have to. Keep your head on a swivel, watch for the changes, and whatever you do, don't ask for too much. That kind of desperation can be a remarkable power source, endlessly renewable, completely unsustainable, but endlessly renewable. So this strategy works surprisingly well for certain values of works anyway, and it actually did produce some positive results in my life, to be fair. The second big turn in the course of my life came when I was 22, which is that I lost my parents. They died 6 months apart of completely unrelated causes, and that was the perfect 1-2 punch. The grief smashed everything. Hanging on by my fingernails was all I could manage for 5 or 6 years afterwards, and every part of my life suffered for it. Watching every part of my life suffer, every vicious story of unworthiness came roaring back home. And I got stuck in that because being unable to get past my grief shored up the stories of unworthiness, and the stories of unworthiness sapped the energy I needed to get past my grief. Nowadays, I call it my tour in the hell realm, but at the time, it didn't seem like it would ever end. And this next part is obviously something I can only say looking back from a safe distance. It's half my life at this point. But there's actually something to be said for having acute difficulties rather than vague, nebulous ones. Undeniability is a useful property to have. Because in my case, another big part of the mind that seeks the way comes from the extremely reluctant admission that, hey, my core strategy for life doesn't really work. You can't earn being the one that lived, and there's no holding it together in a world of entropy and random chance. Being careful, thorough, and methodical can't protect us, at least not fully, which is the only way we're interested in. And as an aside, and as a step, I suppose, on the way to Buddhism, looking back at those two commandments of Christ's that I'd liked so much, I never thought the first one, to love God, would be the harder of the two to keep, but it absolutely was. And so far as I broke it with my deep resentment, it did serve to draw my attention, just like a precept, and focus it inward on me and my behavior. Now, fortunately, circumstances change. Eventually, I found myself with a small circle of friends, hobbies to sponge up my free time, even a little professional success. And just like that, I slogged my way through and my tour in the hell realm was over. And boy, oh boy, did I like that. I'd never had much peace before, and I'd never needed it so badly. With a little room to breathe, finally, I could see that when I wasn't busy getting in my own way, life could be beautiful. So the spiritual question of that day was, what is not getting in my own way? Brace yourselves, I had a theory about that. And looking back, it was mostly about using wisdom and sheer force of will to invalidate and destroy destructive thoughts and emotions. I suppose everybody's toolbox has a favorite tool or two in it. You could kind of call it a practice, smallest possible vehicle practice, maybe. And unfortunately, circumstances keep changing. Friends drift away, hobbies lose their shine, professional success dries up and blows away. And there in the face of the thoughts and feelings I was already having, my tiny little one roller skate sized vehicle practice was to respond with, stop, stop it. You know better than this. No, no. And how useful was that going to be, really? Life doesn't have a mute button, right? I mean, you'd tell me, right? You're not like holding out on me. And that's the third big piece of way-seeking mind for me, realizing that actually it's not just that one strategy for life that doesn't really work. None of them do. None of them can. When strategies fail, they break in the places that they're rigid, and having places that are rigid is what makes them strategies. So the new spiritual question was, what is the life beyond strategies? And that's an evergreen question for me, because even knowing that they don't really work, I still sometimes fall back to my strategies when stressed. I started meditating 7 years ago because I was feeling angry, and I don't like feeling angry. I had Sanzen with Domyo a month ago because I was feeling angry, and I still don't like feeling angry. Actually, I've already gone past an important part of the story, which is the part where I get involved in Zen and the Bright Way community. I'd studied a little Zen during that theory building phase I mentioned, but I couldn't get my head around it. Actually, I've studied a lot more Zen since then, and it turns out it's not really a getting your head around it kind of a thing. So I started meditating on my own for stress reduction. I had some sort of meditative hobbies, and I liked the way that flow and absorption felt. I'm still trying to find life's volume knob. And Domyo was going through some mindfulness-based stress reduction material at Brightway. And I thought, okay, fine. As long as they don't try to sell me anything, I'll go and see what they have to say. Becoming a Buddhist was a gradual process that continued long after, but going to Brightway was one of life's accidental pivotal moments, I think. Because I could have stayed true to form and just like bought some Jon Kabat-Zinn off of Amazon and kept on trying to go it alone. The Sangha Jewel really wasn't something I knew to ask for back then. And to some degree, the way that I treasure it is involved in how much of a surprise it is that I treasure it the way that I do. Now, if you've been watching the clock, you've noticed that I've spent half the talk, give or take, on my spiritual life before I ever began an intentional practice. That's because the biggest lesson I've learned from all of this is emptiness. Emptiness, as Thich Nhat Hanh points out, is nothing but a technical term. It's also a shorthand. It means empty of inherent existence or empty of independent existence. Sometimes when ancient masters want to say something is empty, they say it's unfindable, meaning when you draw an imaginary boundary around it to define it, you always find it actually still depends on something outside that boundary. When I go looking for the beginning of my spiritual journey, it turns out to be completely unfindable. The imaginary boundary grows and grows until I have to enclose everything, even the unhappiness of a little boy, so keenly aware of the way others responded to him that he mistook a child's unskillfulness for some kind of indelible mark. But emptiness means no indelible marks, pun absolutely intended. No indelible Tom Sticks or Harriets either. If my life were a movie, you'd think it had been put together by some avant-garde director. The scene transitions are so bizarre and jarring. Is it really all the same character in all these wildly differing scenes? Which one's the real one? Someone who was inclined to a sense of shame and unworthiness might also be inclined to say the real one is one of the ones he didn't like, maybe the first one. That's why the ones he liked didn't stay, right? Because they're not real. But then the ones he didn't like didn't stay either now, did they? So how real could they possibly be? Something that's empty depends on conditions and can't help but change with those conditions. Emptiness is actually how it all lives and breathes. So in this avant-garde movie, destined for the Criterion Collection, surely, which character is the real one? None of them? All of them? Each emerged naturally and inevitably along with the scene, ad-libbed his way around the half-baked script he'd been handed, and tried not to leave too much of a mess for the next guy. And there's so much healing in that for me. No need for blame, no fixed place to lay it. But what about that feeling of unworthiness? Well, I was working with it one day, asking myself, what is this I am not good enough nonsense when I know that I and good enough aren't fixed? And it opened up just a little, so I kept at it, poking it, prodding it, and turning it over. And eventually, it turned into, I'll always want to be better to and for the people around me. Now, this sounds like nothing but a clever rhetorical trick, phrasing a negative as a positive. And to be fair, I do love tricks like that. But there's more to it, I think. The transformation of a lie that feels true into an honest statement of my own heart. I want to call this accepting responsibility, or bringing home something that had been rejected, or the ending of alienation. If you ask me 3 days in a row what practice is, you'll get four different answers. But if you ask me today, practice is the end of alienation. This thing has been with me my whole life. And one day I turned it inside out and out fell this vow. Has that been in there this whole time? Also, wow, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to figure out what better is, aren't I? And that's okay, because questions are alive in a way that answers aren't. If I try to put words to it anyway, murky things come out about wanting to be beneficial or a companion, wanting people to feel seen, bringing a little tenderness into the world. It needs more time in the oven, maybe a kalpa or two. We've all made intentional vows. Right now I'm under a vow to sit zazen every day. Intentional vows have intentional practice. But this kind of discovered vow has discovered practice. And discovered practice shows me it isn't all that important that I can't say it clearly yet. There are things I do naturally and automatically because that's just where the energy is for me. So I'd actually like to ask Domio or the host to ship you all off to breakout rooms now for, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes, whatever is the usual, with a question or two. One, where is the energy for you? Don't worry if this doesn't fit well into words. Mine certainly doesn't. But fumble with it a little and see what comes up. Or two, if you already have a sense for where that energy is, what develops it or stifles it?
About how many people per room?
4 sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks. I meant to tell you I was going to do that beforehand.
Oops. I gotta do it automatically. Everybody will get. There we go.
Okay, so we're probably all back now, right? Seems like. Okay. So I'd love to end on a on a high note with a sense of progress and growth. Who doesn't love a story with a happy ending? But that would be neat and tidy in exactly the way that life isn't. Even if I bleach the desperation out of them, my strategies still exist as tendencies. I still try to earn it sometimes, and the phrase earn a living can be really painfully literal for me at times. I still tend to overthink things. I've been working on this talk for weeks. I still want peace for all of us, but I also still sometimes mistake quiet for peace. And knowing that, what do I really mean by peace? All I can really do is what I've always done, which is entrust it all to the liveliness of those questions and the way the questions keep coming up and keep drawing me forward. And that's probably the last piece of the way-seeking mind, especially since it's the end of the talk. I'll hand it off to the larger group for discussion. I'd love to hear where the energy is for you. I'd love to hear what your questions are, or comments, or building upon any of this. The whole thing is meant as a springboard for conversation among the Sangha.
Thank you, Mark. That was great. Appreciate it and all the work you put into it.
Mark, that was a very profound talk. That was really wonderful. And I even took a few notes. I write really small and I just said, they're like, hey, can you give me some of my notes? So we were a little confused about like where is the energy and what exactly was the question. But we had a good conversation and about you know, those things that drive us to practice. And then we talked a little bit about, you said something about alienation, and practice is the end of alienation. I wrote that down. And then Bob said something about friendship.
Son, I'm sorry, Son. I'm having some audio problems. I just realized you're speaking and I can't hear you.
Oh, can you hear me? How about now? No?
No, this is on my end. This happened earlier.
That's okay.
I am going to bail out of the talk real quick and hope that restarting the program fixes it. Sorry.
Oh my.
Great talk. That's all I can say.
Oh, I know. It's such a bummer when that tech stuff happens when you're the one presenting.
Oh, yeah.
I was leading a training with like 20 people and my internet went off and I couldn't get back on for about 15 minutes. It's like, oh my God.
Well, I would just like to say that, Mark, you gave a very moving and zen-like and deeply felt talk, and I really think it was wonderful.
Yeah, I will certainly echo that. And I've also been trying to take notes, which is struggle because, of course, then I start missing whatever the next good thing was. So half of me says, was this actually recorded?
Yeah, I wouldn't even mind reading this. If he has this written up, I would love to have this to read, because I think it thought it really was very, very, it just hit a lot of points. It hit a lot of personal things for me too.
It is being recorded, is it not, Domio?
Yes. So, did you want to finish your kind of question?
Oh, yeah. No, I just thought Bob said something about friendship, and then that made me think of, it was the Upada Sutta, is that it? The conversation between the Buddha and Ananda, where Ananda declares that Sangha And friendship is, he said, this is half of the holy life, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie. The Buddha replies, don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path. And so one of the things that struck me was after Mark's period of grief coming out of that, he said he noticed he had a circle of friends. Mm-hmm. And that's when he knew he was coming out of it. And so me, I've been dealing with a lot of medical issues and pain and ugh, and you know, I bottle it up and I, you know, it's been rough. So, you know, it helps me to come here and connect with Sangha or to my AA Zoom meeting or to call a friend. And when I start doing that more, I notice this relief. And that is such an important part of spirituality. And it's the end of alienation. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank all of you.
Thank you for your truth and for your vulnerability.
Thanks.
So I did love when you said words to the effect of no life strategy works. And then actually when I'd say something even more kind of useful, which was, you know, strategies break in the places that they're actually rigid. But of course, something that's not rigid isn't really strategy. And that left me with this great tension of realizing I will always be trying to figure out how best to live. And I will always be discovering that that doesn't quite work and changing it. But that's okay because that is the only way to do it. There is no other way.
Yeah, that line is a reminder to myself as much as anything else.
Mark, I am really so grateful for the effort that you put in to discovering or expanding on your way seeking mind. You are always so articulate. you choose words that very well. And I think I haven't put that work in, you know, so I don't think I have, I don't think without doing the work that you've done, there isn't a lot I can say, but I do know that finding Bright Way and Dharma Rain to begin with, and then Bright Way most recently, and having a path that allows me to appreciate and have access to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha in a way that our classes and our sessions and our spiritual Sundays have made me comfortable. I have a path. There are some pointers, and much of them is each of you or all of us, because I get so much from that, but also the leadership that Domino provides is comfortable and challenging sometimes, and but I feel like I'm not hanging loose. I have some anchors, and so I'm very grateful to all of you, and Mark, especially your effort in putting that together.
Yeah, even beyond individual Sangha friendships, which I treasure like I treasure any friendship, like some of all of the what you call the work that I've put in, it's just a bald-faced acknowledgement that I don't feel like I have a choice. And so some of the value of Sangha is realizing that there are other people that feel like they don't have a choice. Like they have to dig, they have to look above and beyond, you know, loving individual people dearly, just knowing that there are lots of people that are sort of committed to these questions about life and looking deeply is part of the value.
You just reminded me, Mark, of my, when I first encountered Buddhism and Zen and Sangha all at once. And I was only 24, which for many of us, that's quite a young age to encounter the Dharma, but I already had plenty of years of neurosis behind me at that point. And I just remember having like that end of alienation. I've had felt like all my life, with the exception of maybe just a couple people occasionally, I felt like I was an alien. I was like, what is this all about? What is this for? What is the meaning? What, it just a struggle, a kind of spiritual suffering and inquiry that the people around me were like, they just didn't, in terms of way-seeking mind, essentially, I mean, not to sound judgmental, but essentially their way-seeking mind had not arisen. They're like, this is cool. This is fine. I've got a job. I'm going to go on vacation. It's, I mean, there's just, they're like, why are you asking what this all means? And then when I encountered the Sangha, I was just like, oh my God, these people been here all along. these people who are like, you know, reflecting on their lives and their own behavior and their own communication with others and their wisdom and their clarity. And, you know, and I was just amazed, and I've never been without that since. So it's sometimes it's useful to remember, like, yeah, I didn't always have that.
Mark, I already chatted to you, brilliant talk. What I'm experiencing, without any comment, and it's just the experience, is through your talk, a tremendous sense of release. Just a release of energy. Yeah, that's all.
Thanks.
Mark, thank you very much for your really wonderful talk. Lots of facets to it. I also appreciated that practice is the end of alienation very much. It reminded me that I've been working on these things for a long time, but invariably you have to return home. I spent many years trying to run away, and it doesn't work. So practice brings you back over and over again. And you have a relationship with yourself. Really, that's the most important thing to be in the world. So thank you. It just brought up a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, Just in the last couple of days, I find myself coming right back around to the noble truths, right? And feeling like we suffer because we don't want to hurt. and finding in my case that when I find a way to relinquish the suffering, the hurt is there where it's been waiting patiently all this time. And that's what's asking to come home. That's what I'm ending the alienation of, at least right now.
Mark, this is Joe. I'd like to thank you for your talk. You know, I was only Well, I met you, I guess I should say, on our previous book club meeting. And I expressed to Lori how articulate and well-read you were. And I expressed that to our daughter also. And she is on the meeting this morning. This is her first ever Buddhist function, I guess you can say. And you didn't disappoint. It was above and beyond my expectations, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you too, Mark, for your talk. There was a lot that was, I was like, oh, I wish I had a pencil and paper. But as some people have already said, what really stood out is practice as the end of alienation. You have some great phrases. I like how you also said a vow dropped out. I'm like, oh man, waiting for that vow to drop out. I need that right now. But on a personal level for me, it just spoke to, I guess, where my energy is. What's happening with me is just trying to connect and be part of something. So you helped me to understand Sangha and connection. That's spoke to my heart. Your whole talk kind of spoke that way to me. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm still curious about that difference that I mentioned between peace and quiet when I get frustrated with everything, right? There's this sense of, well, there's a lot of energy there, but what is it? And I'm still curious about what will happen if I figure out how to turn that inside out someday, what will come out. So I'm glad you got some mileage out of that, because it's still part of the process for me.
Hi, Mark. It's Bob.
Hey, Bob.
Peace and quiet. That struck me, and I have a suggestion that since those, you know, it can be difficult to describe those two things and to understand or appreciate the differences, and I believe that it probably falls away when you can actually experience the thing that is beneath or below thinking, the thing that is underneath thinking, which you could say is emptiness or whatever like that, I suppose, you know, or suchness, or but the thing underneath the thinking or before thinking even will maybe make the difference between those two things irrelevant.
Hmm. That's interesting. I'd been tinkering with
just a suggestion.
Thank you. Yeah, part of me suspects that quiet comes from peace. But
well, they're linked. Yeah, I think they're linked for sure. There's no question. But then, you know, to become peaceful and to embody the Buddha way is to probably not have to wrestle with those two terms, but just to find that thing underneath.
Peace doesn't care about the difference between peace and quiet.
So, Mark, what do you
not
mean?
Really,
by,
not
what
really.
Do you mean
it's
by the difference?
It just comes.
Mark, what do you mean by the difference between peace and quiet?
Well, that's one of my open questions, right? Quiet is this wish to not be troubled, this wish to not be dragged into things. It's a turning away, and it's why I ask people about what stifles their energy, because that's one of the things that stifles it for me. peace doesn't seem to care about involvement or uninvolvement, right? Peace is more all-encompassing, whereas quiet is particular and phenomenal. But then when you talk about cultivating peace, you can only cultivate phenomena. So I chase myself in circles. Right on.
That's good.
I have a question that's probably, the answer to which is probably a talk in its own right. But we talk about phenomena a lot, and especially in our chanting services. What are phenomena?
Am I supposed to feel bad or get out of the way?
I will leave this here if anybody wants to offer something that's cool. But like I said, it's probably a talk in its own right. So I
do won't. You want the like scientific dictionary definition? Because I teach that to my science classes. So,
oh, cool.
A phenomenon is any object, process, or event that you can observe in the natural world. So basically everything you can interact with in your senses, which in Buddhism would be, you know, touch, sight, smell, taste, hear, and then also think about would be a phenomenon, which is like most things if you think about it. Yeah.
I like
so it. That's the scientific definition of a phenomenon. Yeah.
And it's the same as a Buddhist one, and it's basically everything. It's everything, and all things are empty. All phenomena are empty of that inherent existence. Mm. And yet, that which we seek cannot be apart from phenomena.
Mm.
There's a line, I don't know if it's still, I think this is an old version, but in neither the probably the precious mirror samadhi or harmony of difference and sameness. But basically, if from your experiences of the senses, basic truth you do not know, how can you know the path that certain is?
How,
we can't know anything that we can't sense or interact with. So it can't be somewhere else. We think the truth is somewhere else. Like there's phenomena that are empty and the real goodies are off in some ethereal realm of apart from phenomena, but that's not the case. Yeah, you're right. Whole talk in and of itself, right?
Amanda, this is Bob.
Hi.
You are a phenom.
Any closing words, Mark, before I do our, closing dedication?
No, just have a lovely day, everyone.
Okay.
Thank you so much. So abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have
Thank
a good
you.
Day.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Mark.
That was wonderful, Mark. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mark.